There are two handouts. There's a single page that's headed Laws of Human Development, and then there's the notes for chapter 16. I just want to mention a couple of things about that focusing retreat that I mentioned last week, in case anybody is interested. First of all, I went on to the event last night, and the book Focusing by Gendlin, even though it was published in 1978, is available in a mass market paperback from Amazon.com for $7.95 US. That's a bargain. And other related books on Gendlin and other books by him can be purchased from Amazon.com. If you're interested at all, whether you can make the retreat next week or not, for $7.95, I'm just saying this in connection with this course, because the book really is one way into the appropriation of a lot of first-level material, first-level of consciousness material. And what I have found in reading the book and starting to do some of the exercises that it recommends in there, and this is one of the reasons I think that Lonergan found the book so compatible, is that it's a perfect illustration of the cognition of fear. He has you ask questions about your, first of all, to gain a space, so you're stepping back, you're in this, you've got the kind of aesthetic distance that he speaks about in the first chapter, where the conditions for insight, when he speaks about the way insight has to emerge with when the questions can have a life of their own. And then you raise questions, and you wait for an answer. And then you formulate the answer. And the formulation gives rise to further questions, and so on, and so on, and so on. And it's exactly, and you don't make a judgment until there's a sufficient accumulation of insights and evidence. So it's a perfect illustration of the kind of thing that he's talking about, but done very simply, very much in a common sense way. And what it illustrates is that insight in the dramatic pattern of experience is the kind of thing that is necessary for working with personal difficulties, problems, and that sort of thing. Because it's in the dramatic pattern of experience that you go to it, that you do these exercises. You're not doing focusing exercises in order to understand the laws of metaphysics. Okay? It's a completely different type of the pattern of experience that you're in. You're in the dramatic pattern, and you're trying to negotiate the dramatic pattern, but you're trying to negotiate it authentically. And there's a way in which the book is really a set of exercises, not only for appropriating first-level stuff, but it's exercises in the kind of thing that he's talking about that enables you to do that appropriation. At any rate, from Amazon.com, the book it's a bargain, and I really do recommend it as a complement to this course. If you are considering the retreat is on. I called this weekend. We have six people, and they only needed five as a limit. They do not have a student rate, but they do take Visa, MasterCard, and debit. So you can pay, and that way you don't have to pay as much. So that's enough on the retreat. If you're interested and you want us to make the reservation for you, just let me know and I can do it for you. Just if you want to call, I can give you the phone. And then Greg says five MP3s are still, is it five you still have? The third set or four. So if anyone wants the third and last of the MP3s of Lonergan's lectures on insight, there are four more. Okay, so we're taking up still with the second part of chapter 15, but instead of going to those expansive notes that you had for last week, I've summarized the material of the first. There are actually five laws of human development that he runs through there, and the first three are what we went through last week, so I've summarized those first three on one page. First of all, then, so we'll start with that one page, the single page, Laws of Human Development, review of 1 to 3. And then we'll go to the notes for 4 and 5, of the Law of Limitation and Transcendence and the Law of Genuineness. So first of all, then, at any stage of one's life, whether it's in infancy, childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, maturity, old age, or whatever, one is an individual existing unity identity whole, And one is differentiated by conjugates. One has different conjugate forms at different levels in one's being. Physical, chemical, organic, psychic, intellectual, moral, religious. Moral and religious here in parentheses because he hasn't treated those topics yet. Conjugate forms, habits, displaying themselves in schemes of recurrent events or acts, exhibiting themselves in recurrent acts. So my intellectual habits, for instance, revealing themselves in recurrent acts of questioning and inquiry, reflection, and so on. Now, the organic, the psychic, the intellectual, the moral, and the religious are flexible. They exhibit not fixed schemes of recurrence, which would be the case with the organic, for instance, where the circulation of blood, okay, it's fixed schemes of recurrence unless something happens to interfere with them. But otherwise, it's fixed. It just flows. It goes on and on, and it's a self-mediating, mutually self-mediating process within the individual. It's got a whole thing on organic mutual self-mediation where the circulatory system, the respiratory system, and so on, they're all mutually self-regulating, okay? He's got a whole treatise on that or a whole part of a paper on mediation. All right, but those schemes are fixed unless, you know, something happens and you've got, you know, the bad cholesterol or something like that, and then the schemes get changed. But otherwise, it just goes on, fixed, and the schemes. But especially the psychic and the intellectual and the moral and religious, there is a greater flexibility. There's a certain flexibility at the organic level, but it becomes greater the more conscious the development is. For instance, the flexibility would be something like this, that at the intellectual level, the same problem could be solved in several different ways. And it will be solved in different ways by different people, depending on different factors in them, their temperament, the way they study, and all of that. And everybody's different along those lines. The goal itself of intellectual development can shift, right? You start writing a book and you think you're writing it about Christology, for instance. And then you realize, well, in order to do Christology right, you gotta get the Trinity first. And so your goals shift, and you may spend the rest of your life trying to figure out the Trinity, and then you may never get to anything further from that. It's just autobiographical. Or there can be regression and breakdown. Okay? There can be regression and breakdown in the schemes. Or your experience can shift into diverse patterns that will affect the course of your development. All right? You may be geared to a certain point in your life to an aesthetic development, to something like music. You know, this was autobiographical because when I was a child, I was a singer and I played the piano, and I thought maybe I would develop as a musician, but I didn't. It switched over away from aesthetic and into at least a devalued intellectual pattern of experience or something like that. But anyway, development took a shift. A clear example of what he means by flexible circles and ranges of schemes is given in the book on page 495. It's a difficult phrase, flexible circles of ranges of schemes. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, okay, let's just look at this here. The dramatic pattern of one person dealing with other persons. It draws upon all one's resources, but it's going to be different depending on who it is that you're dealing with. It subdivides like the successive coatings in an onion into a series of zones, from the ego or moi intime to the outer rind of the persona, so that you're aloof with strangers, courteous with acquaintances, at ease with your friends. Occasionally you unbosom yourself to intimates. You keep some matters entirely to yourself. You refuse even to face others. It's the same set of resources, but going into different patterns, different schemes, depending on the circumstances. There's a flexibility. There is what in Topics in Education and a couple of other places, Bonnerian calls the freedom of consciousness. And by that, he does not mean freedom in the sense of self-determination, free will, making decisions, it just means that consciousness shifts. It's not fixed in rigid schemes. It's flexible. The flexibility of consciousness. So that's the first part of what he has to say about human development. Secondly, we develop in the areas of neural, psychic, and intellectual, and moral and religious conjugates, normally, we do develop in those areas, and normally along the lines of least resistance, the law of effect. There's a kind of spontaneous development there. But in fact, we all know that that spontaneous development is not enough. And in chapter 18, we'll see why, because we're under a law of moral impotence. There is a vicious circle in human development. And he begins to introduce the theme of the vicious circle in human development in this chapter. There's a little bit more about it in chapter 16. But it becomes a symphonic emphasis. It becomes like the fourth movement in a symphony in chapter 18 of the book. He's introducing the theme here, and we'll see it today. But we're under this law of moral impotence, so that just going along the line of least resistance is not enough. Because there will be the line of least resistance will not lead us to development according to the development that we're capable of. What is needed is an anticipated law of effect, that certain coincidental acts will set up the potency for higher integrations. Namely, in other words, we can anticipate. We can anticipate where we want to be and anticipate a goal of development and then take the steps to get there. But those you will not get to that goal simply by going along the line of least resistance. One does not become a great musician just by going along the lines of least resistance. One has to practice. And you have to take the classes, and you have to find the teachers, and you've got to go to the places where you're going to do it. That's what he means by the anticipated law of effect. You can't just go along the line of least resistance. The same is true with moral development, and intellectual development, and religious development. There are times when you have to step back. Religious development, people go and they make retreats, okay? And sometimes they make long retreats, 30 days, 40 days. They go into the desert. In order to find what's necessary in order to get to the goal where they want to go. They won't get there just by following the spontaneous unfolding, letting things flow. That isn't to say that a lot of times just let things flow, yes, but there are times where there has to be a stepping back and saying, all right, what actions have to be freely chosen at this point in order for me to get where I want to get? I've got to find a teacher who will help me, a philosopher, a musician, an artist, whatever. William McNichols, who was here for the ICOM presentation in November. By the way, if you were there, he's got his voice back. But he went to the best teacher in North America, Robert Lentz, to learn how to do this. He couldn't do it just by himself. You've got to find the circumstances that will enable you to be what you want to be. The law of integration. No matter where the initiative of development begins, organic, psychic, intellectual, external, the various levels of our being have to correspond to it. They've got to catch up with it. Okay? If a person is has had a profound dream, is opening up onto new possibilities in that person's life, those new possibilities are not going to unfold unless other levels of the person's life catch up with what they're dreaming. You've got to give them time to do that. Or if there's a profound insight that someone has had that could affect even a field of thought, the rest of one's being has to catch up with that. I wonder sometimes how long it took Lonergan, the rest of his being, to catch up with the fact that he was onto something that possibly could be extremely important for a lot of people. But the rest of his being had to catch up with that. the intellect, and someone particularly, it's a problem with genius, the intellect is way ahead of the rest of the being sometimes. You know, the rest of the self can fall behind, but you've got to give the rest of yourself time to catch up. The road to hell is paved with good intentions that did not take effect because the needed integration didn't take effect. One knows what one has to do, but the body's got to come along with it, or whatever. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Sometimes we'll see the flesh is willing, but the spirit is weak. There's a possibility of that as well. The parable of the sower and the seed in the Bible. The sower falls on, the seed falls on all different kinds of ground, and only the ground that's able to assimilate it in all, at all the levels will give rise to continuing production, harvest. And those of you who want to pursue this whole thing in chapter 8 of Theology and the Dialectics of History, the chapter is called The Psyche and Integral Interiority. The complexities of this kind of integration are analyzed, more so than modern ones. How complex it can be for all of the various levels of our being to operate together. And this is particularly under the influence of psychic trauma. It can be extraordinarily difficult for the psyche of people to allow what they know is the way they ought to go to actually happen. And what has to happen to free that? There's a whole analysis of that in there in that chapter. All right, so those are the first three of the laws of human development that he treats in chapter 15. Now we can go to the notes. The notes from last week, chapter 15, part 2, number 4, number 27. The fourth aspect in human development is the law of limitation and transcendence. To put it in common sense terms, we can't get bogged down in the limitations of our present situation, and we can't be going so far beyond where we are right now that we're attempting what is impossible for us where we are at the present time. There's a law of limitation and transcendence, the two things functioning simultaneously in human development. If we simply give up because of the limits that we know are true, we're denying our own potential. If we try to do more than we're able to do at the present time, then we're neglecting the underlying base and it's going to collapse. There won't be the integration that is needed. So development is in the subject and of the subject. On the other hand, it is from the subject as one is towards the subject as one is to be. That is the simple statement of the law of limitation and transcendence. The subject as I am right now is under certain limitations, but that doesn't mean I have to stay with those, with all of those limitations. I can transcend some towards the subject as one is to be. And that can go on through one's whole life. That's why people who grow old gracefully, they're still living according to the law of limitation and transcendence. That even as they are growing old, there's a spiritual transcendence that is taking place that is enabling them to grow old with dignity and with grace. And not to be harboring bitterness and resentment against all the hurts that have happened to them in their lives and all of that sort of stuff. Law of limitation and transcendence. The subject as one is a unity of laws, spontaneities, habits, and schemes, as I am right now. I've got certain, that's why people say, this is just like you. This is you, you know. Oh, it's you, you know. Because we know what we can expect from each other, if you know people well. You know what the laws, the spontaneities, the habits, the schemes are. But finality, that upwardly directed dynamism, is always trying to change the laws, the spontaneities, the habits, the schemes. There's a dynamism in us to change and develop and grow, to introduce new laws, new spontaneities, new habits, new schemes. Okay? And that's part of what's in us. That's the transcendence thing. That's potency as the principle of finality, of transcendence. Potency is a principle of limitation, but also of transcendence, of finality. The direction of this dynamism is against our remaining just as we are. There's something in us that says, all right, You have to stay just as you are. You don't have to get bogged down in too little possibility. While such a tension is inherent in the finality of all proportionate being, and that's why the universe has unfolded from physical to chemical to biological to psychological to human, that's that finality, it becomes conscious in us. It's not conscious in universal process until animals emerge. That's where it becomes conscious. It's conscious also in us, and it's very complex. It's a very complex matter. As we all know, I mean, actually negotiating our own development, it's a very difficult matter to maintain this ever-shifting balance of limitation and transcendence. What am I capable of? All right, that's a function of the limitation of my being at this particular time, but even asking that question, what am I capable of, is an indication of the dynamism towards moving beyond those limitations. So how far can I go at the present time? When I was once teaching a course in Jung, at Marquette University, there was a student there who was also in the military, and I think that was his question sort of indicated. But can't we do this all at once? You know? Jung was talking about individuation, the process of individuation, which is the process of assimilating the various dimensions of one's being, the shadow side of the masculine, men assimilating their feminine side, and women their masculine side, and so on and so on. That's a long, drawn out process. Why does it have to take so long? You know? Why can't we do it all at once? Because of the law and limitation of transcendence, one step at a time. That's all. It's a lifelong project, human development. And on pages 497 to 99, he introduces for the first time what will become the theme of moral impotence. He doesn't use the expression yet, but the theme of a potential vicious circle in human development. This will become a symphonic emphasis by the end of chapter 18, where the dominant expression for it will be moral impotence. Here's one expression of it. We realize that our present perceptiveness is too narrow. We're not seeing enough. We're not taking account of enough. We know that it has to be enlarged, that more has to be brought within our ken. But the enlargement itself is not perceptible to present perceptiveness. And that's the difficulty. We're caught. We know that it has to expand, but where? How? Where do I go? What do I bring in? Present desires and fears have to be transmuted. We know that. There's a desire to get beyond these fears, to get beyond certain being locked into certain desires, especially if they're addictive or whatever. We know that. But the transmutation is not desirable to present desire, but fearful to present fear. It's a very well-written, rhetorically, very well-written statement, but we're caught. We know that we've got to move beyond the addiction, for instance, if the desires are addictive desires, but that's not desirable to our present addiction, and so it goes against it, but rather fearful to our present fear. We're also afraid of what that's going to do. Or again on 498, because psychic development is so much more extensive and intricate in us than in other animals, it is involved in a more prolonged tension, and it's open to more acute and diversified crises. At a deeper level, the pure desire to know reveals to us, or to one, a universe of being in which one is but an item, and a universal order in which one's own desires and fears, one's delight and anguish, are but infinitesimal components in the history of humankind. We see that, and that we can despair over whether is there any importance at all. We see that in my own desires and fears. But it doesn't invite us to despair. It invites us rather to become intelligent and reasonable, not only in our knowledge, but also in our living. And to guide our actions by referring them, not as an animal to a habitat. That's not enough for us. Just eating and sleeping and having sex, that's not enough for us. But as an intelligent being, to the intelligible context of some universal order that is or should be, is to be. So somehow we have to find our place, not just in an animal habitat, but in a universe, and in a community of human beings. Still, it is difficult for us, even in knowing, to be dominated simply by the pure desire. And it is far more difficult for us to permit that detachment and disinterestedness to dominate our whole way of life. This is what Jill was talking about last night, if you were able to go to the lecture on the Carmelites. The detachment is emphasized in the spirituality of John the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Edith Stein in particular, those three. Detachment not in the sense of uninvolvement, but rather in the sense of a stepping back to clear space so that development becomes possible. To allow that detachment and disinterestedness, namely in what's in it for me, to allow that to dominate our whole way of living. The Bhagavad Gita, act but renounce the fruits of your action. You must act. You must act authentically. But don't worry. It's the Sermon on the Mount. Do not be anxious about tomorrow. What you are to eat, what you are to drink, where you are to live, and so on. Seek first the kingdom of God, and everything you need for your life will be given to you. That's what he's talking about here. There's nothing more difficult than to live in that kind of disinterestedness and detachment. For the self, as perceiving and feeling, as enjoying and suffering, functions as an animal in an environment, as a self-attached and self-interested center within its own narrow world of stimuli and responses. And if we were just that, we would be less than human. We would be accepting a life that was less than human. The same self, as inquiring and reflecting, as conceiving intelligently and judging reasonably, is carried by its own higher spontaneity to quite a different mode of operation with the opposite attributes of detachment and disinterestedness. But he's not saying that we should be just that either. Okay. We've got to accept. And the next law is that we're both. He puts it somewhere, I didn't quote it here, but as my questions are mine, so is my sexuality. As my religious aspirations are mine, so are my dreams. They're all me. The I is not this, independent of that, nor is it this, independent of that. It's that. It's the two together. It's confronted with a universe of being in which it finds itself not the center of reference. And we know we're not. None of us is the center of reference for being. But an object coordinated with other objects and with them subordinated to some destiny. What is the destiny? Why are we here? Some destiny to be discovered or invented, approved or disdained, accepted or repudiated. So in all of us, there is on the side of the object the opposition between the world of sense of ourselves as animals and on the other hand the universe of being to be known by intelligent grasp and reasonable affirmation. And on the side of the subject is the opposition between a center and the world of sense operating self-centeredly and on the other hand an entry into an intelligently ordered universe of being to which we can belong and in which we can function. And only through detachment and disinterestedness. Only by stepping back and clearing that space so that we can function in that universe. There's no way out of this tension and opposition. It's something that is present in every life. Neither pole can be neglected at any point in one's development, even though the content of each pole will change as one develops. But I cannot neglect the animal side of myself and all that it means, what is required is a transformation of that into a human work of art. But I can't neglect it. And nor can I neglect that there is the continual movement to move on, the continual invitation to move on in my development and to become more and more self-transcendent, as And then fifthly, the law of genuineness. Genuineness basically is bringing this tension into consciousness and living with it and not trying to escape from it. Not trying to escape from it, but living with it and facing it as it is. So that, if you want it in brief, just that's what he means by genuineness. It is bringing the tension of limitation and transcendence fully into consciousness as it affects me at this particular time in my life. Not abstractly, but concretely. All right. What is holding me back? And what is inviting me forward? And that's going to be the answer to that is going to be different for each person. If you've ever directed 5 or 6 people on retreat at the same time, every one of them has a different answer to each of those questions. What's holding you back? What are you being invited to? So it's concretely bringing these into consciousness, not in an abstract sort of, you know, just abstract philosophical pondering of the issue, but rather the concreteness. The good is always concrete. It's always concrete, and there's no way of determining what it's going to be at any point. There is a way of determining what would be evil, okay? But there's no way of determining precisely what the good for a given individual to do is, except by bringing into consciousness what is holding one back and where one is invited to go. So it's conditional and analogous. It's conditional in that it arises only in as much as development occurs through consciousness. And it's analogous because it varies. It varies from one person to the next. Some people, the simple and honest person, there are a few of them left in this world, not too many, but for whom it just, you know, they just seem to move on. And it's just the spontaneity, and they are authentic and genuine. But for most of us, there's need to, for it to be won back, for genuineness to be won back. As he puts it in Method and Theology, authenticity is always precarious. It's always a withdrawal from inauthenticity. There's always the tendency to go this way, and go this way, and not to live in balance and in attention, and to allow that unfolding to continue to develop. Because it's the actual tension will shift as we go forward. Karl Rahner, in his article on concupiscence in Theological Investigations, said something that I think is quite relevant to this discussion, because he has said that in the course of the history of Christian spirituality, we have always tended, if I may put what Rahner is saying into these terms, he doesn't use these terms, but he's said that from Augustine on, we have tended to view concupiscence as always being displacing the balance in the direction of so that concupiscence has come to have the connotation of the orientation to sensuality, to lust, to gluttony, and so on and so forth. But what Rahner also emphasizes in that is that I can also imbalance in the other direction, losing the ground, pride, over ambition, you know, what's it all about? That's what you want to ask of the executives in all of these corporations who are risking heart attacks and everything else in order to control economic empires, but ever moving on without any kind of sense of limits on their aspirations. And concupiscence can be the imbalance in either direction. It's a very healthy emphasis that Rahner puts there. But we've got to think that it's equally concupiscent, the tendency to head in the direction of transcendence without taking the limitation into it. Genuineness is living in the tension. So leading up to discussing it, we may say the following. Every development involves a starting point in the subject as one is, a term in the subject as one is to be, and a process from the subject as one is to the subject as one is to be, from the starting point to the term. The law of genuineness states first that conscious development involves some apprehension of the starting point. So where am I? This is one of the things that genuine stuff helps you get at. Where am I right now? What's going on? Okay. The subject as right now, the starting point of this next development. Some apprehension of the starting point. Some apprehension of the term. Where do I want to go? And then along the way, how's it going? The process. These apprehensions may be correct or mistaken. If they're correct, then all systems in the person, conscious and unconscious, will be working together along the same line, towards the same goal, from the same starting point. But if they're mistaken, you're going to get a conflict of the various systems. They will be at cross purposes. And there will be conflict that will be experienced consciously, that will come into awareness through dreams. And dreams can show that kind of conflict. There's something that's saying the course you're on isn't right. There's something not right about it. It's not the way for you to be going. So if a development is conscious, its success depends on correctly apprehending where I am now, where I want to go, what are the steps to get there. These apprehensions may be minimal or they may be extensive. They're minimal when they involve little more than the succession of fragmentary and separate acts needed to carry out successive steps of the development with advertence, intelligence, and reasonableness. And that's really where most people are. And that's really what happens in most counseling and most spiritual direction and so on. Is, okay, what's your next step? Where are you? But then there can be more extensive, fuller apprehensions as people delve into the background, the context, the premises, the interrelations, and so on and so forth, and bring it all under empirical laws of psychological or philosophical theories of development. That can be an escape, of course, from actually facing what you've got to do in your own life. There is an easy way to escape into the head. But on the other hand, there's nothing more practical than a correct theory. And that's definitely the case when it comes to human development. If you've got the correct theoretical framework, it has tremendous positive practical effects on the living. And there's nothing more inimical to practical living than a bad theory. These complex explorations themselves can go astray. And then things become even worse. Lonergan speaks about, in another place, the difference between the infrastructure, which is just life going forward, and the superstructure that attempts to reflect on life going forward. And if the superstructure gets it all wrong, it bollocks up the infrastructure as well. And it has negative effects. I refer to it, with the transformation of Freudian terminology, as primary process and secondary process. The primary process is life simply going forward. The secondary process is theories reflecting on life going forward. If the theories are erroneous, the life process itself gets screwed up. Because it has a negative feedback on the life process itself. Where am I here? Incorrect apprehensions, whether minimal or extensive, displace the tension of limitation and transcendence. That's the problem with a superstructural or theoretical account that is incorrect, is that it's displacing this tension. It can be encouraging us to live only for the moment and to live a life that is too bogged down. And that isn't enough for the human heart. Or they can be encouraging us to deny human company, to deny human familiarity, to deny enjoyment. St. Ignatius, in his own spiritual development, made that mistake. Okay, and it was from a somewhat, quasi at least, theoretical understanding of spirituality, he went too far in this direction. He made his initial retreat in Manresa. injured his physical health for the rest of his life by doing that. And he said, this was a mistake. God didn't want me to do that. That wasn't God's inspiration. And he said, I would never allow anybody to do that. But he went too far in the direction of transcendence, not keeping this, not eating enough, not sleeping enough. Thinking that he was engaged in self-denial for the sake of becoming God's child, and instead what he was doing was really a part of God's creation. He felt that that was actually sinful on his part to do that. Okay, so the tension in its full integrity, or in its integrity, is described in the following words from pages 501, 502. On the one hand, there is the subject as one is functioning more or less successfully right now in a flexible circle of ranges of schemes of recurrence. On the other hand, there's the subject as a higher system on the move. We are both that. We're both of those at the same time. One and the same reality is both integrator and operator. The self as integrator, I've pulled it all together as much as I can, but the same self is operating further development. By asking new questions, by saying, let's try this, by going in this direction, and so on. And the operator is relentless in transforming the integrator. There is no end to that transformation. There is always a next step to be taken for as long as we live. There's always a next step, and that's the transformation of the integrator. Let me pause for a minute here and just talk about one of the difficulties that I find in Jungian psychology. I've said a lot of things last week positively about Jung and vis-a-vis Freud, but the Jung's symbols of the self are all symbols of the self as integrator. Particularly the mandala symbol, which is one of the privileged symbols of the self in Jung's psychology. It's the symbol of the self as integrator. He does not have a symbol of the self. An archetypal symbol of the self. I think you'll look in vain in his books for any expression of an archetypal symbol of the self as operator. And Lonergan provides that, at least from an intellectual point of view, by speaking in questions. Because questions are the operators of development. They're certainly the operators of intellectual development. And the moral question is the operator of moral development. And then God's grace is the operator of religious development, and interestingly enough, that grace as operating development was called, in St. Thomas Aquinas, gratia operans, operative grace, grace operating development, grace coming in and changing a person's heart, turning it around. It's operative, it's operating development. So there, and that's not in you, those things, the question, whether it's questions of understanding and reflection or questions for value, that's not really emphasized there. Not that he's opposed to these things, it's just that his theory hasn't caught up with it. And then this, grace as operating development, religious development in particular.
But doesn't that mean that this operating grace, let's call it grace, always has to come from outside?
It does.
And from outside, would necessarily have to put the person in relationship with the world. I mean, in relationship with other people.
Yes.
I guess I'm asking this question because it seems to me that when we're talking about limitation of transcendence, we're so focused on the person as an individual, and we're not really focusing on the relationships of the person.
No, I don't want to leave you with that impression. Remember what he said, that the source of the development may be anything. It may be organic, it may be psychic, it may be intellectual, it may be external. It's right in the notes and it's right in the book. The initial inspiration can come from a conversation with somebody else.
But it seems to me that this is necessarily external.
Grace. Yes, it is.
And hence, authentic transcendence is necessarily external. It's not something that is coming from within.
Okay, there's a combination of factors there, I think. By the end of the book, Lonergan himself will say that sustained fidelity to the transcendental precept is impossible without grace. So this, the transcendental, to be attentive, experience, understanding, judgment, decision, that's nature. Right? Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible, that's natural law. That is natural law for a lot of people. Natural law is nothing more than that. Those four transcendental precepts, period. That's it. But sustained fidelity to natural law, because of moral impotence, because of the vicious circle of human development, is impossible without grace. Now, grace may never be acknowledged as such in a given life if a person's not in a religious milieu. That doesn't mean it isn't present. It's an existential, in Rahner's term, that is a supernatural existential. It's always present. God is always present in our lives. And God is always doing what God is doing. Healing, redeeming, saving, calling forward, elevating, so on and so forth. God's always doing that whether we acknowledge it or not. And that is most often mediated through human community. I don't think you can say it's always mediated through human community. We've got the St. Paul on the road to Damascus. That was a direct intervention. Right? And I think it happened just as it's recorded in the Book of Acts. And it was not mediated through human community.
But it's still external.
It was external. It's external to him. It's God. Okay? But not God working through anybody else. It's God affecting his heart directly. Not through any instrumental causality, to use the medieval terminology. Gratia operans frequently works through instrumental causality. It works through other people, it works through events in one's lives, and so on and so forth. But there are times when it can be, in some lives, and Paul is one of the clearest examples in history of that. If in fact he was simply knocked off his horse, voice, and that wasn't his head, and it wasn't the people he was with. That was the external force was different.
So when Lonergan will talk, and I'm desperately waiting for that, the falling in love part, that is what is sustaining this whole natural process.
The habit of charity. In this book, it'll be called the habit. Well, first of all, it will be called universal willingness. At this point, what it is detachment and disinterestedness. These are all the same things. Okay. At this point, up to this point, it's the detachment and disinterestedness that are necessary for one to keep moving on. That will become, in chapter 18, universal willingness. We'll take on that terminology. He's remaining with philosophical terminology for as long as he can. Finally, in chapter 20, will become the habit of charity. And that's falling in love with God and being in love in an unrestricted way. And that's what it does. They're all the same thing. Or they're all interrelated. Consistent detachment in the true religious sense, the kind that Joe Goulding was talking about last night, is impossible without being in love unrestrictedly with the unrestricted source of love. Because being in love unrestrictedly is being in love with the very love of God. And that's Lonergan's point, and that's his understanding of Romans 5:5. God's love has been poured forth into our hearts by the Holy Spirit who has been given to us, so that we love with the very love of God, the created participation in the active and passive spiration of the Trinity. God's the Father and the Son sending the Holy Spirit, and in us, sanctifying grace is the created participation in the Father and the Son sending, and the habit of charity is breathed forth from sanctifying grace in us as the Holy Spirit is breathed forth in the Trinity by the Father and the Son. So, but that's the theological thing that this is all leading up to. He's just teasing us now in some ways. But he's getting at things that are very intimate to our experience. He's only beginning to introduce this thing, the need for something else, because of the vicious circles that we can get into and develop at this. this is only beginning to come in. And it comes in a little bit in this chapter, a little bit in 16, a little bit in 17, and then it hits you. Okay. All right, so let me just finish this. Let's finish this material in 15 before we take our break. I deliberately cut down what I'm going to cover in 16 because I think this material is so much more important for theological students and it's much more interesting to a lot of the stuff in 16 is not that interesting. So one and the same reality is both integrator and operator, but the operator is relentless in transforming the integrator. The integrator resides in successive levels of interrelated cognitive forms that are more familiar under the name of acquired habits. We've got habits for this and habits for that and so forth. And so that's where we are right now as the present integration has come together. But habits are inertial. The whole tendency of present perceptiveness, present affectivity and aggressivity, present ways of understanding and judging, deliberating and choosing, speaking and doing, their whole tendency is for them to remain as they are. They all want to be challenged. But against that solid and salutary conservatism, salutary at least in the sense that it's safe, there operate the same principles that gave rise to those acquired habits in the first place, and now persist in attempting to transform them. Unconsciously operative is the finality that consists in the upwardly but indeterminately directed dynamism of all proportionate being. We're a part of that, the passionateness of being. Consciously operative is the way we participate in that, the detached and disinterested desire raising ever further questions. Among the topics for questioning are one's own unconscious initiative. Their subsumption under the general order that intelligence discovers in the universe of being, their integration in the fabric of one's habitual living. Suppose you find out that you're unconsciously or not deliberately, but you're doing something that is continually self-destructive to you, or community destructive. So there emerges into consciousness a concrete apprehension, and that's the emphasis. Of an obviously practicable and proximate ideal self. But along with it, there also emerges the tension between limitation and transcendence. Okay, that's possible for me to get there, but I'm not there yet. And it's no vague tension between limitation and transcendence in general, but an unwelcome invasion of consciousness by opposed apprehensions of oneself as one concretely is, and as one concretely is to be concrete, and that should be concrete there for something like L-Y in those words. Genuineness is the admission of that tension in its integrity into consciousness. This is what it means to be a genuine person. Later on, he'll adopt Heidegger's terminology, if not Heidegger's meaning, and talk about authenticity. Then the conscious and unconscious components will be more apt to cooperate harmoniously. Or again, to take a rather lengthy quotation, genuineness does not brush questions aside, smother doubts, push problems down, escape to activity, to chatter, to passive entertainment, to sleep, to narcotics, to the internet. It confronts issues. It inspects them. It studies their many aspects. It works out their various implications. It contemplates their concrete consequences in one's own life and in the lives of others. If it respects inertial tendencies as necessary conservative forces, in other words, don't push me too far too fast, okay? That's legitimate. It does not conclude that a defective routine is to be maintained just because one is grown accustomed. It fears the cold plunge into becoming other than one is. It does not dodge the issue, nor pretend bravely, nor act out of bravado. It is capable of assurance and confidence not only in what has been tried and found successful, but also in what is yet to be tried. It grows weary. And we do. We get sick and tired of this sometimes. Just leave me alone. With the perpetual renewal of further questions to be faced, It longs for rest. It falters and it fails. It knows its weakness, however, and its failures, and it does not try to rationalize them or perpetuate them. Now, on 502 and 503, again, I want to call your attention to this, again, because it's coming up, again, this theme. It's really like a Beethoven symphony. You get a little bit of a theme in the earlier movements that will become the main thing in the fourth movement. Theme that will emerge with increasing importance, the vicious circle that is broken only by an emergent leap, and the question will become, where does that leap come from? We cannot become wise and discriminating without concentrating on the right questions. Yet we cannot select those questions unless we are already wise and discriminating. How do you get out of that? It's not a logical process. There is an emergent leap into some kind of wisdom. Where does that wisdom come from? It comes from the, for now, it comes from the community. It comes from human interchange. A creative response that meets the requirements of moral precepts, inner impulses, external circumstances. Eventually, however, we will see the need for a source of detachment beyond the pure desire to know. An existential source that underpins and sustains even the notion of being. This is the first approximation to universal willingness, establishing the tension in a kind of integrity prior to and conditioning correct apprehensions, to charity as the condition of the integral dialectic of limitation and transcendence. So that in theology and the dialectics of history, if I can just do this for a moment, there are, I take Lonergan's five of value, vital, social, cultural, personal, and religious. I don't want to go through this whole thing because it would take the rest of the class to do, but there are relationships from below upwards and relationships from above downwards among these levels of value. The levels of value, by the way, correspond are isomorphic with the levels of consciousness, experience, understanding, this is the good of order, judgment, decision, personal value, religious, the level of love, religious love. So they're isomorphic with the levels of love. But from below, you've got to have a certain amount of health and strength before you can commit yourself to the good of your society. You have to have grown. We don't expect 5-year-olds to have good ideas on social order or who should they vote for, you know. So that there has to be a growth in vital values before one can contribute to the society. The society has to have certain infrastructures in place if cultural values are going to be pursued. There isn't going to be the chance. If a society is falling apart, and there isn't going to be the chance for growth in universities and in music and symphony and art and so on and so forth. You've got to have a social infrastructure to develop that. Personal value emerges out of culture. Right? So however much genuine cultural values are flourishing, it will have an awful lot of influence on the development and the emergence of the person. And then the person is not the source of religious values, but the person is what calls forth the emergence of religious value. I should put this arrow from below upward should stop there. That shouldn't go all the way up to the ridges. Now, from above downwards, however, problems at one level can be solved only by something from a higher level. And the one that we're on right now is that the gift of charity by the end of the book will become what is necessary for the limits, for the tension of limitation and transcendence, which is what personal value is all about, to be kept in its integrity, for us to abide in that tension. That's what charity does, the habit of charity. It enables us to abide in the tension of limitation and transcendence. Further things just for the moment, personal values will have an effect on culture. Genuine persons will be agents of cultural change. Cultural values will influence the transformation of the society towards justice and integrity. And a just social order will provide for the equitable distribution of vital goods to the entire community. So it works that way. But with the one that we're talking about right now is right here. I mean, we haven't really gotten to this yet, but I'm anticipating it. He's talking right now about personal value. Personal value is abiding in the tension of limitation and transcendence, but we can only do that under the influence of something other, and that's the gift of God's grace. And then finally, the sanction, to fail in genuineness, to fail in keeping this tension in balance in ourselves, is not to escape, but only to displace the tension. Such a displacement is the root of a lot of problems. Scotosis in the individual, the bias of common sense, basic philosophic differences, and their prolongation in natural and human science, morals and religion, educational theory and history. And then I indicated at the end there what Rahner came up with, which I spoke of earlier, that the displacement can occur in either direction. It doesn't have to be just what we've emphasized from the time of Augustine down to the present time, displacement towards the body, but there can also be displacement towards the spirit, so that we forget that we're in the body, and that we're not being free. We're a little bit over time. Let's pause now, start the next part with questions on this, and then we'll take, I'm going to abbreviate the discussion of things in chapter 16.